This episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, it's been a place to grow, connect, and serve. Of course, during this time, no in-person gatherings are allowed, but that doesn't mean that church is canceled. You can find their live stream on Sundays at 9 a.m. on their website, canbyfoursquare.com, or on their Facebook page. Services and other encouragement is available on their Facebook page anytime. Just search for Canby Foursquare Church.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
It was Pappy's Greasy Spoon in downtown Canby that opened Friday and Saturday for in-person dining, in violation of Governor Kate Brown's orders prohibiting restaurants from offering anything but takeout, curbside pickup, and delivery. Pappy's owner, Mike Merrill, told police officers, who responded to his location Saturday morning, that he was aware of the violation, but quote, "the to-go meals were not cutting it, and he has bills to pay." Canby police visited Pappy's at approximately 11:20 a.m. according to the report of the incident, which was obtained by the Canby Now podcast. Officers approached the restaurant and saw through the front door that there were approximately 8 to 10 people inside, seated at tables and eating from styrofoam to-go containers. A waitress was standing near one group of customers, apparently taking an order. As officers walked in, they heard a man seated at one of the tables joke, "Hey, please just let us finish our meal before you shut it down." Officers then made contact with Merrill, who was in the kitchen, cooking. "I figured it would just be a matter of time before I saw you guys here," Merrill reportedly quipped when he saw the police. Throughout the interaction, he was very polite and respectful, said officers, who told him he was welcome to continue offering takeout, but serving customers inside his restaurant was a violation of the current executive order and could put him at risk for being charged with a Class C misdemeanor pursuant to Oregon law. Merrill explained that he had taken several steps to mitigate the risk to his patrons and staff while attempting to stay open, including keeping every other table closed for social distancing purposes. Tables, utensils, and other items were all being sanitized between customers. Merrill also expressed to the officers his belief that the, quote, "coronavirus has been blown out of proportion and the government's attempt to mitigate it are all just a placebo helping citizens feel better." Pappy's Greasy Spoon is located about a block and a half down the street from Countryside Living, a long-term care facility that serves only residents with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, which has seen 10 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and one death. Merrill told police he would keep his restaurant seating area closed and make orders for takeout only. He said he is hoping the governor will open restaurants on May 15th and has a plan to mitigate the risks to his patrons at that time. The restaurant industry has been among the most devastated segments of an economy ravaged by the COVID-related shutdowns. A report last month from the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association estimated that dining establishments in the state have lost over 81% of their workforce, more than 127,000 people. Nevertheless, the state has been aggressive in pursuing alleged or confirmed violations of the governor's orders. A bar in Cave Junction has its license suspended in April for allegedly serving customers on the sly. And the Attorney General last week sent Mayor Dan Holliday a letter threatening significant legal repercussions, including criminal and civil penalties, to any business in Oregon City that reopened before the governor's orders are lifted. But frustration continues to grow. At least two personal care businesses in Salem went on record this week with plans to either open or stay open in defiance of the governor's orders for financial, not political reasons. And on social media, numerous local commentators expressed support for Pappy's decision to open its dining room before being visited by the police. "Wish I'd have known," one person said on our Facebook page. "I'd have been there for breakfast." Canby Mayor Brian Hodson, along with the mayors of Oregon City, Mullalah, Sandy, and Gladstone, called on Governor Kate Brown this week to either dramatically accelerate her plans for allowing smaller, more rural, and less impacted cities to reopen for business, or allow them to draft and implement their own. The five Clackamas County mayors announced their shared position during a virtual press conference Tuesday afternoon. The mayor said they had heard little from the governor's office in terms of concrete plans or a timeline for reopening. She said last week that even the most rural and unaffected areas would not be able to begin the process of reopening until at least May 15th. Said Sandy Mayor Stan Pulliam, quote, "We have been asking our questions about what a reopening plan is going to look like, and we have yet to see anything. We have yet to see pen to paper. We have seen a lot of rhetoric." Mayor Pulliam said his reading of the tea leaves suggests that for Clackamas County, one of three counties that form the Portland metro region, but which also has many smaller cities and vast rural areas, the go-ahead for reopening will come mid to late summer at the earliest. Canby Mayor Brian Hodson, who has typically expressed his support for residents and business owners following the stay-home orders to flatten the curve and facilitate a faster reopening, appeared frustrated this week. "I think we're at a point where we flattened the curve for a week or more now," he said. "We've gotten past what was supposed to be the peak period of the virus. I think we've got a good trajectory. I think it's time we put forth the effort and put forth a plan to get things open." Mayor Hodson described his approach to reopening as cautious and optimistic. "Our small businesses on Main Street, even the ones that are open or open on a limited basis, are barely surviving," he said. "We need to have a plan and put forth some encouragement to show that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We need to see some concrete plans with deadlines and dates much sooner than the one that the governor has put out." Oregon City Mayor Dan Holliday called on churches to lead the charge. "We don't have 2 weeks," Holliday said. "We don't have a month. We need to get this going as soon as possible. So I'm calling on our communities of faith, our churches. You have the ultimate First Amendment right. Step up, open your doors, go back to worship. That'll set the example for the rest of the state." Mullalah Mayor Keith Swigart said common sense dictates a faster approach. He has been asking for 4 to 6 weeks why rural cities can't develop plans that would allow shuttered businesses to reopen, following guidelines similar to the ones that have been put into place for grocery stores, liquor stores, and other retailers. "Why can't we work within all these parameters that have been established to come out with a plan to allow our businesses to reopen?" he asked. "Everything keeps getting pushed forward. In Mullalah, we've had a lot of hardships. We have businesses that will probably not open again. They're done. Things need to change." None of the mayors said they plan to defy the governor's orders if she doesn't move faster. They're just asking for, quote, "a little more control." Mayor Swigart said the ability to submit plans for review and implement them once they were approved. He said, "We just want to show the state, the county, someone, here is our plan. Here's what we thoughtfully put together with businesses, our city councils, with first responders, with our police department, everybody. We want a chance to move this forward. We don't have much time to wait longer." In Oregon, the health authority's latest weekly report Tuesday, which for the first time included case counts by zip code, identified 24 cases of COVID-19 linked to Canby, approximately 0.1% of the population. Mullalah's count was slightly higher at 27 cases, or 0.18% of the population, while Oregon City's was much lower, 22 cases, which represents only 0.04% of the population. By the way of comparison, one of the highest counts in the state is nearby Woodburn, where they have seen 155 cases. The incident rate there is more than five times that of Canby, 53.8 cases per 10,000 people, or 0.5% of the population. A month ago, an emotional Mallory Gwynn looked around his quiet and empty coffee shop in downtown Canby and announced that Gwynn's Coffee House would close indefinitely after the COVID-related restaurant shutdown had decimated their revenue in a matter of days. This week, a much refreshed and enthusiastic Mallory Gwynn returned to his favorite medium, the Facebook video, to share the bit of good news many folks in Canby needed. Gwynn's Coffee House is back! You know those signs we put up, closing for the time being? Gwynn's asked, pointing to the pieces of paper that have been posted to the front doors of the cafe for about 5 weeks. Not so anymore. Here's Mallory.
Of course, it's takeout only, so please call your order in 263-0200. That's 503-263-0200. Just give us a call. We'll get your order up for you on time, and again, we're serving from 8 to 3. We are going to close Sunday and Monday during this time, so just keep that in mind as well. Full menus on Facebook, so you can visit us there, and we'll keep you updated with anything that's going on beyond that. Now is the time to come back to Gwynn's and enjoy some of that coffee and food that you've been looking for. We'll see you then.
Gwynn family, we think we can safely speak for all of Canby when we say, welcome back. Please don't ever leave us again. The Clackamas County Soil and Water Conservation District will host a live online presentation and listening session regarding drinking water quality in the Mullala River watershed on Wednesday, May 13th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. This public meeting will be presented via Zoom web conference. Members of the public are encouraged to participate and will be invited to provide feedback on local drinking water quality concerns. The presentation will also be recorded for those who are unable to attend, and you can provide input now on the Mullala Drinking Water Project's website. These meetings have been scheduled to happen in person in Canby and Mullala in late March, but they were canceled due to concerns over the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. Quote, we have decided to switch to gathering feedback from the community in an online capacity while the stay-at-home requirements are still in place, said Jason Faucera of Clackamas SWCD. We'll still likely hold in-person meetings at some point, but in order to stay on schedule with our work, we'll need to keep moving forward. The district was awarded a National Water Quality Initiative grant from the Natural Resources Conservation Service to assess factors affecting drinking water quality in the Canby area and to better understand issues affecting drinking water quality for the approximately 26,000 people whose drinking water is drawn directly from the Mullala River. While the project focuses on water entering municipal intakes in the cities of Canby, Mullala, and Colton, it assesses factors across the entire Mullala River watershed that have potential to impact drinking water source quality. Clackamas SWCD has hired a consultant to conduct the bulk of the research and technical work regarding the Mullala River assessment, John Runyon of Cascade Environmental Group, and his scientific team are working closely with local, state, and regional agencies to gain understanding of the issues that affect local drinking water quality. They are also pairing current and historic technical information with input from the public, land managers, agencies, and community organizations to tell the story of drinking water source quality in the Mullala watershed. The final report will describe where investment of resources will bring the biggest return for drinking water source quality protection and improvement. For details on how to join the Zoom meeting, find this story on our website at canbynowpod.com. With more people and families staying home due to school closures, layoffs, telework requirements, and other impacts from the coronavirus pandemic, it was only a matter of time before new residents became interested in the areas once frequented by humans. I guess we just thought it would take a little longer before, you know, bears started taking over the streets of Canby. The stuffed critters, which have already begun to populate the bike racks, lamp poles, signs, and storefronts of downtown Canby, with more expected this week, was the brainchild of Shannon Ali of Hot Rod Dreamworks, who says the idea is for people and families to try and spot as many as they can when they go out for a walk or a drive. This is a small activity that I hope will strengthen the bond between customers and local businesses, she explained. The effort, which is also underway in many residential areas of Canby, is part of a global phenomenon. Described as a scavenger hunt suited for social distancing, the teddy bear game is being played from Japan to Australia and all across the United States. Ali encourages local business owners to dress up their stuffed animals to fit what they do, like a mechanic, a waiter, or a grocery store clerk. Those already on display include graduates celebrating the Canby High School class of 2020, various essential workers, including a bear doctor and a sheep police officer, a clown bear, which also features a rotating joke of the week, an adorable pug repping a Hot Wad DreamWorks hat and t-shirt, and even a bear Doctor Who. The bears can also hold a sign reminding people that their businesses is open or a note encouraging them to stay safe, Ali said. For businesses that are closed, the bear could be a friendly and hopeful reminder that they will be back soon. The bear is a message of hope, and I hope we will have bears put all throughout Canby from downtown to 99E, she said. Let's spread a little happiness in Canby. Ali thanked Canby Kiwanis, who donated more than 24 teddy bears to the cause, and also did most of the heavy lifting on outfitting them with various costumes and props.
And now my favorite part of the show, Police Beat, for the weeks of March 3rd through the 9th and 10th through the 16th. On March 3rd, we get things going off just so well. At 1:17 a.m. following a traffic stop, a driver was arrested for unlawful possession of a firearm. Yeah, that's, Canby, just straight up. I love coming back and doing this. 9:30 a.m. report of a theft from a farm store. Specifically, a farm store. On March 4th at 12:48 a.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by an unlicensed driver was impounded. Because that's what happens when you drive unlicensed. On March 5th, report of fraud after an unknown person attempted to make unauthorized transfers of money from a personal checking account. At 4:30 p.m., three theft suspects arrested for shoplifting. At 8:16 p.m., a traffic stop was conducted on a forgery suspect. The vehicle's driver was subsequently arrested for forgery, but then they had to go and just put that icing right on top of the cake and have some methamphetamine on them as well. On March 6th at 8:42 a.m., unknown pills were found and turned into police for destruction. That's where my ibuprofen probably went. On March 7th at 7:02 a.m., report of a stolen vehicle. At 7:12 p.m., 12 full hours later, a concealed handgun unlawfully in the possession of the driver was seized during a traffic stop. On March 8th at 12:38 a.m., after an uninsured vehicle was stopped, two passengers were arrested on an outstanding warrant, and a third passenger, a juvenile, was arrested for minor in possession and curfew violation. At 7:17 p.m., following a report of a swerving vehicle, the suspect vehicle was located and stopped, and the driver was arrested for DUI, reckless driving, and attempt to elude the police. On March 9th at 10:05 p.m., report of a disturbance in a parking lot, probably a disturbance in the force, as well as other disturbances. Nerd joke. Now, moving on. A suspect was arrested for disorderly conduct. probably being a Sith Lord, causing a disturbance. I'm making it worse. Resisting arrest and DUI, controlled substance. On March 10th at 3:20 p.m., report of a vehicle crash in a parking lot the previous day. 6:18 p.m., response to a report of a person shoplifting items from a hardware store. Based on video surveillance, police determined the suspect's identity and retrieved the stolen items. On March 11th at 1:59 a.m., report of three unknown individuals entering and removing items from an unlocked vehicle. At 9:20 a.m., report of an unknown individual entering and removing items from an unlocked vehicle. At 8:28 p.m., police responded to multiple reports of a suspected driver under the influence of intoxicants. Driver was located and arrested for DUI, reckless driving, and probation violation detainer. On March 12th, report of identity theft after an unknown person opened an unauthorized account in the victim's name. That sentence took way too many tries for me to get right. At 3:25 p.m., a found credit card was turned into police. An officer located the car's owner and returned the card to them. At 5:32 p.m., arrest of an individual for violating a stalking order. On March 13th, response to a report of harassment, as well as response to a report of violation of a restraining order. At 11:11 p.m., four individuals were located consuming alcohol in a closed city park. One uncooperative person was arrested on an outstanding felony warrant and cited for minor in possession of alcohol and marijuana. On March 14th at 1:37 a.m., oh, this is Pi Day, that's fun, a vehicle was traveling at speeds of 100 miles an hour, probably go get pie, and they were stopped, and the driver was arrested for DUI, reckless driving, and unlawful possession of a firearm. Also, they probably didn't get pie. Finally, on March 15th at 9:33 p.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by an unlicensed driver was impounded, and the driver was arrested for possession of methamphetamine. Also, at 11:45 p.m., a speeding driver was stopped and arrested for DUI.
Canby, DirectLink is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at DirectLink are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
Hey friends, it's me, James again, just letting you know how grateful we are for all of the Canby Now podcast supporters. These are our Canby Now Plus members who support us via Patreon, allowing us to do this work that we so love. Now, more than ever, we believe that timely, accurate, impartial journalism is at the heartbeat of an effective and unified community, and we want to be of service to you in the Canby and surrounding areas. If you would like to support us in this mission, please consider joining us as a Canby Now Plus member and become one of the coolest people in the world, like Trudy Peters. Trudy, this week we want to say a special thank you for your support of the Canby Now podcast. We are very grateful for you. If you would like to find out how to be wonderful like Trudy, join us and visit canbynowpod.com/plus. Trudy, thank you so much.
Our guest on the Canby Conversation today is Melissa Earlbaum. Since 2007, she has served as the executive director at Clackamas Women's Services, which is the only nonprofit in Clackamas County that specifically provides services for survivors of domestic and sexual violence, dating violence, and stalking. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. How are you holding up in these crazy times?
I'm doing well. It has been a very busy time and a very different time, but our organization is remaining strong in the community, and we're here to support folks, and we're doing really well.
That's good to hear. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, if you would, Clackamas Women's Services and the kinds of services that you provide generally, and we'll kind of discuss if maybe things have changed or if there have been certain focuses sort of narrowed in this COVID era. As well as the family, what is it, the Safe Family Justice Center, which I know
sure.
that you were involved in, and along with another number of other local organizations. And it's a wonderful thing that you guys do for our whole county.
Absolutely. I'm happy to share that. So Clackamas Women's Services has been in the community for 35 years. We started out with our emergency shelter program, which we still have. Today, we also have a housing program throughout Clackamas County. We also have a community-based services program. So our advocates are in a number of different partner organizations like the Department of Human Services or out in the rural community, able to provide support to families. We also have a children and youth services program where we do what we call Camp Hope Oregon, which is a camping and mentoring program.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard of it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really wonderful, really, really wonderful work. Also in that program, we do art-based therapy and parenting support and counseling. We have mental health counseling for both adults and children throughout all of our programs. And then we also have a prevention education program where we go into over 25 schools throughout Clackamas County, elementary, middle, and high school, and we provide prevention education. That's obviously age-appropriate, depending on what classroom we're in. But we're talking with kids about how to support one another, how to identify unhealthy behaviors in a relationship, how to get help, how to talk to safe adults. And through those conversations, which is really focused on prevention, we do hear a lot of disclosures from students where they share with us things that they've experienced in their lives. And so we now have a youth advocacy program where we have a youth advocate that can respond to those disclosures and work with directly with school counselors and provide supports to those families and those children. So it's a pretty broad range of services that we have at this point. And then at our work at our work at A Safe Place Family Justice Center. We are a partner organization there with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm glad that you stumbled over it as well. So.
Yes, it does. I know a lot of, and sometimes my mind goes right to acronyms too.
Right.
So there's that.
Yeah.
But yes, and also the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office as well, and Department of Human Services, Clackamas County Health Services. So it's a wide range, other nonprofits.
Something like 10 different organizations.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. And the idea is it's a walk-in center, or you can call, but you can walk in and get support anytime for experiences of domestic and sexual violence, also elder abuse and trafficking as well. And the idea is to wrap support around families or individuals that are experiencing these issues, and then provide that support in the long term. Because we know there's initial crisis that may happen.
Yeah.
We know that there's abuse that's occurring, but then we want to work with people to reengage with their community, move through that trauma, begin to thrive again, and we stay connected with them for a very long period of time, which is just really wonderful.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for all that work that you and your partnering organizations do. I have to say, like, I have so much respect for the special person that it takes to do this very important work. I could not handle it. I'd probably last like a couple hours and would just be a blubbering mess from seeing probably some of the things and some of the difficult cases that you guys deal with. But very appreciated that there are resources and are people helping folks that are enduring stuff like that. So thank you.
Of course.
So there has been a concern, and, you know, folks listening to this might have seen some of the news stories about this current coronavirus crisis and how that is affecting families and people who are at risk for domestic violence. There's been a number of articles about emergency crisis hotlines and shelters that have seen an increase in the services that they're providing. I don't know if you guys have those numbers, that you've seen that as well, that you could talk on. But I'm looking at an article here as well from the Oregonian that you were quoted in, and you said something really interesting. You said domestic violence lives in isolation, and when there's additional isolation, that obviously exacerbates the situation. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So we are seeing a similar rise in calls and higher lethality cases throughout Clackamas County, and that's been shown through calls to law enforcement, cases that the district attorney's office is reviewing, and then additionally calls to our 24-hour support line, which is a 24-hour support and crisis line that's 100% confidential. Hmm. And in talking about the isolation piece, I think what's challenging in a time like this is, you know, we hear on the news consistently that a virus like COVID-19 thrives sort of in its ability to transmit from person to person in a community.
Yeah.
But conversely, domestic violence and child abuse, sexual violence all thrive in isolation. And so we have sort of two polarizing things happening. Yeah. And, you know, things like family violence or domestic violence, child abuse, isolation is one of the key strategies to keep that abuse hidden until it can continue, and to keep somebody under wraps, if you will. And so when we see a situation where folks are, you know, asked to stay home and asked to isolate, we know that can be really challenging for those experiencing violence to be able to get the help and support they need. There's a lot of fear about, you know, can we leave the house to go get help? Is help still available? What does help look like?
Yeah.
Those kinds of things that we're seeing pretty consistently. And in terms of the data that you see in Clackamas County, we are seeing about, at our support line, about a 60% increase in calls.
Oh my gosh.
And we're also, it's quite startling.
That's heartbreaking.
But it is. And a lot of those calls are for resources, support, safety planning. Sometimes we're also seeing an increase in loved ones and neighbors calling and asking how they can support their friends and their family and their community. And that's really interesting. I mean, it's refreshing in the fact that we have more community engagement. I think that's likely because more people are home and seeing what's perhaps happening with a neighbor or a friend.
Yeah.
And so we're available for that as well. And we're also seeing a bit of an increase in the way in which violence is playing out. So for example, there is a great deal of stress and there's a great deal of financial uncertainty right now.
Yeah.
And we know those things can exasperate violence. We know it doesn't cause it, but we know it can make things more challenging.
Yeah.
And during that time when it's, when folks are experiencing that greater sense of stress, the cycle just sort of continues in a different way. So whereas in a relationship where perhaps the violence played out as verbal insults or emotional attacks, that may increase now to more physical tactics. Mm. We have seen a rise in stalking behaviors and also in surveillance behaviors. So monitoring what people are doing on their phones or on their computers. So it's changing the way in which it plays out. And that's why I really encourage everybody in the community to reach out to the support line. It's confidential. We can talk with you about safety planning. We can get you connected to resources. But also, law enforcement is there as well. We have heard from quite a few victims in the community that they weren't sure if law enforcement would help. They're hearing on the news that perhaps there's some changes in the way in which law enforcement does their business.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Just so that we can make.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, just I think to what you're alluding to there is, you know, that there certain reports and things that they can do remotely, you know, they are in many jurisdictions just to kind of limit that chance of possible exposure. I mean, certainly our folks here at Canby Police and I'm sure Clackamas County Sheriff are absolutely responding anytime in person when needed. So,
They certainly are. And so we want to make sure that folks get that message. And we also want to make sure that they get the message if they have injuries or if there's been a sexual assault, they can still seek medical attention for that as well. So those are really important pieces.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned, Melissa, when you're kind of describing the, you know, hopefully some of these cases that have good outcomes where sort of the increased isolation plays a little bit of a benefit because they're able to see things, or maybe folks, neighbors or other people in their sphere are able to see things that they might not otherwise. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, just in terms of if someone is maybe in a situation that they didn't realize they might be at risk for, but now they're seeing or potentially there are signs that they should be looking out for, or for the other situations you described, as far as like maybe a neighbor or a loved one that you see maybe see a little bit more of than you used to?
Sure. I mean, I think when you see a greater degree of being cut off from your friends and family, when you're starting to feel more concerned about your future, and also what we have seen in terms of the abusive tactics is that in the past, or prior to COVID, I should say, if somebody needed to get to a resource or needed to discuss their situation with a counselor or with a doctor or with a neighbor, they were able to do that without a lot of detection. Mm-hmm. But now that folks are staying home and there's more eyes from an abusive partner on them, it's harder and harder for them to reach out and get that support, which is why it's all the more important that the community and loved ones reach out and check in with people, safety plan with them, have a code word, know how you can get support. Those are really key pieces. Mm-hmm. I would also say that, the ability to take a break is lacking. And so, oftentimes survivors...
Tell me about it. I'm a parent, so.
Yes. Yes, I think we're all feeling it for sure.
Right.
And, survivors, their instincts are usually spot on. And I encourage them to still follow their instincts. They know what's best for them. And, it is okay to still take a break. It is okay to step outside. It is okay to go for a walk, following the guidelines for, safety. But
yeah.
I think there is a lot of misconception out there, and there are abusive partners who are telling their family members that they're not able to leave at all, and those kinds of things. And so just being, getting that information out there for people.
Hmm. I appreciate that. Well, Melissa, certainly without putting anyone at risk for invasion of privacy or anything like that, I find very powerful, and especially for me, fortunately, not having experienced what so many people have, and probably more than people realize right here in our community. But can you give us maybe, especially for people like me, a story or like a real life example of what a victim of domestic abuse here in Clackamas County or in the Canby area has experienced? Some of the stories, some of the things that you do see.
Yeah, so I can give you even a recent example. We had a family that reached out to us. They were fleeing abuse in their home, and we were able to still provide emergency shelter because we are still open to do that. In that process, we were able to provide that family with the electronic devices that they needed to be able to stay connected and get services remotely. In fact, we are even doing art-based therapy with children remotely now, which has been wonderful. And that family, we were able to keep an emergency shelter. And because we have really strong relationships with landlords throughout the community, despite it being a hard time to move, they're working really closely with us and helping us get people into housing. And
that's
so,
great.
Yeah, you would think that that's not happening right now, but it is. And so I want to give people that sense of hope that there are opportunities out there for them.
Mm, that's awesome. So you said that your shelter is still operating.
Yes. Yeah. We're doing it slightly different now in terms of the model, but we are still providing emergency shelter services. And in fact, we're actually providing about 50% more shelter vouchers and shelter services than we were prior to COVID, primarily because other tools are not as available. People are sort of forced to leave their home. They may not be able to move into a friend's or family member's right now because of the health crisis. And so, emergency shelter is their only option. But we're able to provide food and supplies in that scenario, services, and get them into the next step for housing or whatever that looks like for that family.
Emergency shelter in place, as it were.
Yep.
So what other ways have services or operations changed for you guys in the COVID era to keep your staff and the people you serve, lessen that risk of exposure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been really, we were pretty proactive and managed to move our operations virtually
pretty early, which was really
great. And I'm really proud of our team for doing that. And what was fascinating is, we went from having a really important resource in the community that I do hope opens soon, and that's a Safe Place Family Justice Center, where we would have 25 walk-ins a day. And we were able to pivot to being able to do those services virtually. Mm. And what that looks like now is we know that when we start to go back to full in-person services, mm-hmm. that we're going to continue to keep doing some of the things we're doing now. What has been fascinating is once we got people the resources they need, whether that's an internet connection or a device, we're actually seeing it more people attend our groups and more people attend counseling sessions and more people get those day-to-day sort of case management advocacy appointments because some of the barriers have actually been reduced. So as a parent, that it can be challenging to make sure schoolwork's done and, kids have been fed and they have something to entertain themselves so that you can get away to go do something, right? And now we're taking advantage of some of those close quarters and using technology as a way to reduce barriers to folks being able to get in for services.
Sure.
So I see that actually continuing.
Just not having to arrange or figure out childcare can sometimes be the difference between whether I do something or not.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for your time. We don't want to take too much more of it from your important work that you guys do. Do you want to, before you go, is there anything else you'd like to say? Plus, definitely would love to get that crisis number and any other resources that you'd like to share for folks who might be listening to this and need that or need to share it with someone.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the most important thing for folks to hear is that they're not alone. There are resources available, we're available, our partner agencies are available, and what they're experiencing matters. These are tough times, but it does not mean you deserve to be abused or have to experience abuse during these times. Mm. And so I highly encourage folks to reach out for support. Again, we have a confidential line. You don't have to use your real name even. Mm. And that number is 503-654-2288. We also have a confidential chat line. So if you go to our website at cwsor.org, you can do a text chat line that way as well if you don't want to talk on the phone directly. So those are two options to get support. And in terms of the community and friends and family members, if you see something, say something, give us a call. We're happy to talk through it with you, maybe give you some tips on how you can support people and resources that might be available to everyone. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much. That's such a great and important message. I think that, there is a lot of talk about us all being in it together, us all, doing our part and making sacrifices to flatten that curve. And I could definitely, maybe see a victim of domestic violence, sort of that message getting twisted in their heads and being like, well, this is my part. And I appreciate you pointing that out, that is definitely not true. That is not something that anyone in our society expects people to put up with. So.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you. Really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate the opportunity. And I just encourage folks to connect with us. We're here for you.
Take care. Stay safe.
Thanks. You too.
Joining us once again on the Can Be Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
It's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. Interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So
wow.
we're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, you know, spreading the virus and whatnot. But yeah, everything's still moving along.
Cool. So how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com. But just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right. You as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And now, by special request, we present a recent episode of the public access program Piano in the Park from neighboring Malala, dedicated to local first responders, healthcare workers, and others who are on the front line of these uncertain times.
This all started about maybe 6 months ago when we discovered a piano thrown away in a dumpster at Woodburn Dump. And I came to Ken Fetters, the owner of the main shop, and said, "Music's art. We need to do something about it." And so Ken contacted David Alexander here and painted the first piano that we have now in Fox Park. And we had another piano that came into being. It was a part of David's family. And he was inspired to, since this one was going to the fire station in the gazebo at Long Park, was inspired to come up with the imagery of first responders. The first piano we put in at Fox Park, we had a two or three people there. It wasn't a big hoopla. It was just, "Here, city mayor representing our city, here's a piano for you." This piano evokes so much emotion.
Yes, it does.
So we're not going to let this piano go in our park without a hoopla. So we're here honoring this piano, honoring David for the inspiration, representing the heroes that are out in the community fighting the COVID thing. We're going to have Dr. Carter come up here a little bit. She's in the front lines taking care of people. So with that, I just want to say thank you for coming here today and for David to have the inspiration and the vision to paint this piano in the style he's done. And then I'll let the mayor say a few words.
Where do I start? I'm a veteran. I didn't have to fight in any wars, and I thank God for it. This is very important to the city of Malala to honor first responders, our vets. If everybody here, I'm sure, remembers 9/11, when people were running away from the towers, our first responders were running towards the danger. And that's what they do. I have no idea how, why, or what special person it takes. I went to our police academy in Almsville. I just thought, you know, I want to be a policeman when I grow up. Well, you can have it. It takes a lot of dedication, and you people are amazing. Veterans, you got to go to war. They have to go. They go and fight. And so we can be free. This started a vision from Bob. We had a vision plan for our city, visioning plan that two council members that care very much for the city came up with. And this is what spawned from it. Bob had an idea. He went to the head of our Arts and Culture Commission, and from there on, it took off. This gentleman here did a fantastic job painting it. And yes, we're proud of it. We're proud of our first responders. We're proud of our vets. And like Bob said, we're not going to put this up and be quiet about it. We want everybody to see it. We want everybody to be proud. We want everybody to have the respect and honor our first responders and our veterans, including our doctors and nurses. They went to the hospitals when other people were saying, "No, thank you." And so they're there too. They're just as important.
Well, my name is David Alexander, and I'm a local artist here in Malala. And I was asked to help with painting pianos in the park was the original idea. And then, and since there's a long park, which is right next to the fire station, I thought it would be a good idea to use this opportunity to honor the first responders, in whether it be in military, police, fire, the EMTs. It was all, I just wanted to make sure I included everybody in that that was a first responder, because I believe that they just, they can't get enough honoring. They do a very, what I feel is very respectful, very honorable job, very very dangerous. And I wanted to just take this opportunity to show them that they're appreciated. And this is the start of the work here.
Well, I'd like to introduce myself and give you some of my titles. Like most people that live in Malala, we wear a lot of different hats. And I am the Senior Vice President to the VFW Auxiliary, Malala 3973. I am the chaplain for the district, and I am the Department of Oregon soloist and publicity historian. So I'd like to sing the national anthem for this this occasion and dedicate this piano to our history and to Malala. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watch, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the
So we have representatives from first responders that, from my left, Dr. Carter, practicing medicine and has treated COVID-19 patients. She was Thyla's, my late wife's doctor, and just a great person to take care of others. And I think what I'd like to do is, rather than just go through the line with Mice Mike, I'm going to let them introduce themselves, and I'd like them just really say a few words of why they do what they do. Why do you take up this profession? And kind of leverage from what Keith was saying. He was thinking about being a policeman and he decided not to. But there are policemen here and sheriff deputies, and I'd like them to just say a little bit about why they do what they do. So I'm going to give this mic to Dr. Carter.
Hi, I'm Dr. Annalise Carter, and I work at Malala Family Medical Group, as well as one of the local hospitals. I think medicine is a great way to really serve others, to ease suffering and save lives. And it's a great privilege to work with the other first responders in our area to serve our neighbors.
So I'm Brian Lister. I'm a deputy with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. I grew up in this area. I've been here since 1980. And still live here, actually pretty close to where we're shooting today. But I became a police officer in 98 as a reserve with Malala Police Department. And at the time, if you'd asked me why I did it, it would have probably been something about helping people and a cheerful answer. And now it's changed a little, but it's still mostly about helping and about helping other officers and just creating a better world for my kids to grow up in.
I'm Sergeant Bobby Call with Molalla Police Department. I started my career in 2010 as a reserve police officer with Molalla. That's volunteer. I was hired full-time in 2014 with the Molalla Police Department as well. I did join this career for the purpose of helping people, and I chose Molalla because, as Deputy Lister said, I grew up here as well. I feel this is my community, and raising my kids in this community, as well as the friendships and relationships that I've built over the years, and I'm just honored to today to be part of this.
I'm Lauren Johnson. I'm with Molalla Fire. I started in 2010 also. The reason I started becoming a firefighter was because of my childhood. I was actually diagnosed with leukemia and had 10 years of fighting cancer. In those 10 years, I had multiple first responders, nurses, doctors showing me compassion, showing me hope. So through that whole time, I've wanted to do the same. I wanted to make sure that there's always hope out there, and to make sure that no matter how hard life is, you always can come to the fire station, you can always come to our local police, our churches, the whole community of Molalla is out there to help. So ever since then, I've just wanted to retire here and love the community.
I'm Chaplain Bill. I serve emergency responders in this area. I have to harken back years ago when my brother was killed in the Air Force, and people were so good to me to support my brother and I and my mom and dad. That was the beginning of my chaplain career, and I didn't even know it. Over the years, people have been wonderful with me through cancer, other traumas. I have a beautiful wife who's supported me, and I just want to give back. So for 25 years, I've responded on calls to mainly trauma calls to try to support the people that are out there on the front lines.
Good afternoon. My name is George Carroll. I'm the state senior vice commander for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. I'm also a local post member. Been in the community for basically all my life. I started out in Colton, and we moved up by Bob's folks as about 40 some years ago, and have been around ever since. Our local fire is one of the reasons why I'm able to be here today. There was a time when I was trying to get ready for a new house and doing a little tree pruning, and the next thing I knew, our fire department was there. I didn't know who all was there, but I recognized some of the voices and faces. Next thing I knew, somebody on the helicopter said, "We're 7 minutes out." Next thing I knew, I was in the hospital. So their response was very quick and very likely was able to save my life. And I really appreciate all the hard work and dedication that these people do.
Our feet were blocking the bottom of this piano, and a personal note for me, Lauren has been to this house two or three times, and my wife was battling cancer, and Lauren and his team came to the house, walked up the stairs, carried Thyla out of the house because she was incapacitated, put her on the ambulance. And the symbol down here is real. I've experienced it. And Lauren, with compassion and caring, just dignity, took care of Thyla. And I just thank you so much for doing it. I appreciate it.
I definitely thank God for all of our firefighters and all the staff with Molalla. Thyla was a wonderful, wonderful lady. No matter how hard she was battling cancer, she always had a happy smile on, always made sure that we were doing good, even though she wasn't. So She will always be in my memories and always in my heart.
Canby Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. They're open daily. And even though the store is currently closed for walk-in sales, they offer a variety of online shopping experiences along with free delivery. And Canby can connect with them through their email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. We have much more to tell you about the Lee family, but first comes the story of how Canby got its name. You may remember from our earlier episode in this series that Canby was originally known as Baker Prairie, probably named after James Baker, who settled north of town in 1838, although it may also have been Macaja Baker, a 19th century trapper about whom little else is known. The name Baker Prairie can still be found around town, such as on the Pioneer Cemetery on Knightsbridge Road, and the much newer middle school, which was given the name as a nod to the area's history. So, where did the name Canby come from? Believe it or not, it was named after a man who never lived here, never even set foot in the town, as far as anyone knows. But U.S. Army General Edward Richard Sprigg Canby was a well-known, in his day, a Union hero in the Civil War who led the defeat of General Sibley during the Battle of Glorieta Pass. This decisive battle in March 1862 is known by some as the Gettysburg of the West and marked the end of the Confederacy's attempted invasion of California. Canby later accepted the surrenders of Generals Dick Taylor and General Edmund Kirby Smith in Mobile, Alabama. Ulysses S. Grant, Union commanding general and future president of the United States, had much to say about Canby. He considered him more skilled in matters of administration than actual soldiering, and criticized him at times for not being aggressive enough. Grant later wrote, "There have been in the Army but very few, if any, officers who took as much interest in reading and digesting every act of Congress and every regulation for the government of the Army as he. His knowledge gained in this way made him a most valuable staff officer." In other words, he was what we might be referring to today as a policy wonk, someone with a rich aptitude for technical details and strategy, but with a weakness for practical applications and dealing with people directly. Following the war, Canby, whose father had owned slaves, was estranged from some of his relatives who had fought for the Confederacy when he refused to grant them favors as a military governor during Reconstruction. Canby was often stationed in some of the most volatile regions of the convalescent nation, including Louisiana, Texas, Virginia, and South Carolina. Clashes were common between whites and blacks, Republicans and Democrats, imagine that, federal and state government, and Canby was always at the center. His tendency to rigidly uphold law, order, and just principles, while grudgingly admired by many, often made him the bad guy in times of conflict, and he was prone to alienating one side or the other. In August 1870, Canby was assigned to the Pacific Northwest, and this is where his story aligns with that of our town. As we mentioned, Canby most likely never set foot here at any time during his life, but someone who definitely did was his good friend and confidant, Ben Holliday. Blunt, gruff, and enterprising, Holliday was a speculator who had managed to get himself appointed president of the O&C Railroad that was being built through the heart of the town. Holliday had a lot of pull at the time, and though the exact details will never be known, it's generally assumed that the well-known rogue pulled the strings necessary to have the town named in honor of his dear friend. What we do know is that when the community's first plat was filed in 1870, it bore the name Canby and not Baker Prairie. You'd think the gesture would have been enough to have the guy at least visit here once or twice, but whatever. The truth was, Canby had his hands full in his new post in Oregon. He was soon embroiled in a feud involving the Modoc people, who had been forced to share a reservation in Oregon with their traditional enemies, the Klamath. When the U.S. government refused to allow the Modoc to return to their native home in Northern California, the tribe left anyway, sparking the Modoc War. The MODOC entrenched themselves in a lava bed near Tule Lake in extreme northern California, where the terrain offered numerous advantages to the defenders. The place became known as Captain Jack's Stronghold, named after the MODOC chief. The MODOC held the stronghold for months, their band of only 53 warriors holding off army forces numbering as much as 10 times that. By the time General Canby arrived on the scene, the government was interested in talking peace. But in a tense environment, the MODOC got the wrong message. Captain Jack received word through his spies that the general intended to capture him and his warriors and put them to death without a trial, something Canby would have never allowed. The peace parley was set for April 11, 1873. General Canby agreed, although he had been warned that the MODOC were volatile and he would be in danger. He reportedly said, "I believe you are right, but it would not be very well for the general in command to be afraid to go where the peace commissioners would venture." For their part, the MODOC were plotting to kill Canby and the rest of his party under the belief that peace was not possible. They were determined to fight until we die. Captain Jack himself was reluctant to agree to the ambush, believing it to be coward's work. He wanted to give the general one last chance to give him their home in their own country. Surely, having no idea what was at stake, General Canby refused on the grounds that he did not have the authority to grant such a request. It was then that the MODOC attacked. Canby was killed by Captain Jack and one of his lieutenants named Ellen's Man. He was shot twice in the head and his throat was cut. Canby was the only general to be killed during the American Indian Wars. In the aftermath, a reinforced contingent of over 600 army soldiers stormed Captain Jack's stronghold and forced a splintered retreat. Captain Jack and three of his lieutenants were captured in June. They were convicted of war crimes for the murder of General Canby and Reverend Eleazar Thomas at the Peace Commission meeting and were hanged on October 3, 1873 at Fort Klamath. Well, on that pleasant note, we'll wrap things up this week. We have much more to tell you about Canby's founding families, but we'll have to wait until next time on Canby Then.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.